Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. We often talk in this program about the incredible animal kingdom, the beauty of the animals that roam this planet, their odd adaptations to their environments, how they might behave in a way that seems human-like. But we rarely talk about the enormous contribution they make to the health of the planet that we live on, literally creating habitats out of nowhere, mitigating climate change, pollinating the entire world, and creating all the food that we rely on. Animals do this by eating, pooping, and dying, and we'll be speaking to Joe Roman, who's written a book about just that in a few minutes' time. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can tweet us, we're at Newstalk Science, or you can WhatsApp us, or 087-1400-106. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by a doctor and immunologist, Laura Dungan, and TV's favourite science guy, Phil Smith. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Phil, has to do with speakers underwater.
Yeah, and not like the presentation kind where you're like giving a TED talk underwater, which would be very bubbly. We're talking about corals, which are obviously, actually, quick question. Are in your minds, are corals animals or plants?
Animals.
Yeah, okay, Grant, you know then. Yeah. Years ago, I was like, they have to be plants. They're like a garden. No, yeah, they're definitely plants. They're small little mini anemones made up of polyps, and then they come together to form this common ecosystem, which really, they're really, really important because they form the kind of the bedrock of support from anything from algae to fish, right up to like sharks and turtles. So they're a really big part of the food chain and the biodiversity of our planet. They have about 0.2% coverage of the planet, but they make up about 30% of the biodiversity. So there's
not crazy.
It's massive. They support 500 million people in terms of food through fishing. They protect about tsunamis and swells. And we've lost a lot of them. We've lost about 50% of them in the last 30 years. And maybe about 90% in the next century is predicted. So it's a big thing. So this research is showing that underwater speakers that kind of broadcast the hustle and bustle of a thriving coral can bring back life to damaged and degraded reefs that are in danger of becoming graveyards. So what researchers are basically doing is they're taking recordings of somewhere that's working, it's healthy, and then they're releasing kind of coral larvae. And what they're finding is that in the US Virgin Islands, in the Caribbean, they're seeing that about 7 times more likely to settle on a struggling reef where they've played the recordings of the snaps, the groans, the grunts, the scratches that form the symphony of a healthy ecosystem. So they're thinking that this might be something that they might be able to use to put speakers out in other areas and help them to grow and grow the gardens. They did it quite well in terms of that they, I thought initially was like, well, maybe it's just the energy and the cleaning and everything that's done, but they did the experiment really well where they did 3 different sites. All the speakers and equipment was the same on the different sites. And the one where they saw the speakers, they saw that in the proximity of the area of the speaker, they saw this growth really coming back. So this could be something that researchers think might be able to actually start giving us our gardens underwater back.
That's really cool. This sort of soundtrack that we're playing to con the coral into thinking that they're in a healthy place. I mean, do they know the mechanism by which this is working? Like, why is it working? Because there aren't more nutrients there, that, you know, there aren't more animals there. Why would they grow quicker just because of the sound of it?
Well, this is kind of why I was asking at the start about, did you know if they were animals or plants? I suppose because they have sensory inputs and they're looking to actually take on that. They're floating around essentially looking where's the best place to thrive. And if they see that there's other or feel that there's or know that there's other things around, they're more likely to survive as well and kind of fit in with them. I think the one of the interesting things as well that the researchers are doing is that they're looking to find places where coral will thrive. They're not just trying to trick them in terms of like, here, come here and settle and repopulate. They're looking where they'll actually go beyond the boundaries of this, these speakers as well. So it's kind of like they find a place, this is good, stay here, the stuff is here, but it's not necessary. The infrastructure is there, almost as if like the IDA have come in and built the site and now they're ready to do all the bits. So the infrastructure is there. So they seem that they want coral to settle in spaces where they'll thrive. And by playing the shrimp cracking and all that other pieces, they'll think that it's a good spot and away we go.
Laura, we covered menopause in a show a couple of weeks ago, and I learned that humans are a very rare mammal in that we menstruate. And whales are one of the mammals that also do this. This story is about whale menopause.
Yeah, it is. You're right. And they are very rare. There's over 5,000 mammal species in the world, and only six are known to go through menopause. Obviously, humans, and then six species of toothed whale, they're called. And this paper was just published in Nature, and it comes from the University of Exeter. And what it looked at was the evolutionary benefit of menopause, because it's a very odd thing for us to go through. If you think about it, the whole point of Darwinism is that we are there to reproduce. And in theory, when we stop reproducing, why would we be evolutionarily useful? Now, obviously, humans live because we've got healthcare, and that's different. But why on earth would it happen with whales? And what they think is happening is that the older female animals, so for instance, in these five species, which are orca, false killer whale, beluga, narwhals, and short-finned pilot whales. And interestingly, orca are not actually whales. They're the largest member of the oceanic dolphin family. And they're also not killer whales. They were whale killers, and it was misrepresented over the years. But the females can live well into their 80s, and the males die at 40. And they think that this gives an evolutionary benefit because the females are actually able to help with their children and their grandchildren to raise them. And obviously, if your children and your grandchildren survive, then so does your DNA. So it makes still Darwinian sense. And the reason they think this works is because the older females will literally share food, not even just help them find food, they'll do that too, but they will share food to help keep their children and their grandchildren alive. I know personally my children wouldn't be alive without my mother, so I totally see how this works. But it is really fascinating. You couldn't imagine how menopause could have an evolutionary benefit. But if you keep your children and grandchildren alive, then your DNA lives.
Yeah, I mean, sharing food is one thing. Do they also protect the young from attacks? Is there any other evidence to suggest that they're protecting their DNA?
That this is why they survive. Well, the key ones that the researchers have found is about food, but obviously all orcas, especially orcas, because they're the ones that I would know the best, they will always protect the pod, and they will look after the young, and they will viciously attack anyone who tries. Now, that is probably inherent. The males will do that too. So I'm not sure that that is a specific benefit for the women in terms of menopause. But the big thing was the food and sharing food.
Why don't males fit into this category? Like, why do males not live longer to protect their offspring?
Because they don't protect their offspring, and therefore they don't live longer.
But why? But you know, this theory of evolution is that we're handing down our genes. That's what the whales, male or female, want to do. Why do we not see this behavior in men?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose in 5,000 species, we don't see it for males or females. So it is a very rare thing to see it. And obviously, there is an inherent desire for a male to procreate. But if you think about it, they don't even try and help raise their children in the vast majority of species. So really, once procreation is done, it's kind of left up to the woman. So I suppose it would make sense that it would only be the woman that would evolve to have this extra added life after menopause.
Phil, you're recently a father. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Are you sticking around to look after the baby, or are you off now? You've done your job.
I don't know. My job's done. I'm just the best of luck. It's like Sparta here. You know, look out and find yourself.
Our third story has to do with snakes.
Yes. No sooner has St. Patrick's Day been and we've gotten rid of them all, now they could be the solution to our protein needs. Steak snake, or snake steak, could be the climate-friendly source of protein that we might need. So pythons are what have been researched and looked at. They turn their food into meat pretty effectively, and a study have found that they could be a kind of an intriguing alternative to climate unfriendly cows. So we are acutely aware of the methane and everything else that cows produce. and how much of an impact they are having on our planet, particularly in terms of greenhouse gases. So having an alternative, because we have so many people in the world and they need protein in order to be able to grow, to sustain. So you might be putting aside your chicken cutlets, your meatloaf, your beef, and saying hello to python, paninis, pasta, and satay skewers. So they think that this is the real interesting thing, that some snake scientists think eating these reptiles, which are already a customary or at least acceptable in different parts of the world where their diets are less constricted. No? Okay. I'll try other snake puns later on. We'll go with that. Interesting what was happening. So we had Dan Natch, who was a herpetologist at the Macquarie University in Australia. This idea kind of came out tangentially. They weren't looking for this. They were looking at different things and kind of found it. Him and his colleagues were working at existing commercial python farms, which exist in Vietnam and Thailand, to determine whether they could distinguish wild bred snakes from captive bred ones. And during the study, the researchers noticed that the farm pythons had a real propensity for speedy growth. This had already kind of been documented, but they knew that they had impressive physiologies. And then speaking to python farmers, they really had physiologies that were really resilient, so they could be left for months without food and, you know, still sustain themselves. So particularly two things when we saw in the pandemic, where food supply or food chains were limited and livestock were damaged or they couldn't transport them to other places. It's a really resilient food source in that they can survive in harsh conditions and they can grow really, really quickly. And then they don't have this output of gases. So they've studied numerous pythons and they're kind of seeing that these could be a solution for future challenges in providing that protein for us. Do you think you can eat it? No, I know it's mad.
This is just, you know, this is a with all due respect and love to geek herpetologists, this is just a guy who loves snakes who's like, hey, I got a story, I got an angle for you. Like, no one is going to be harvesting snakes to eat. And don't snakes eat mice? Why don't we just eat the mice?
But
like,
you see,
I mean, it's all ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And this is, you know,
when people talk about us.
It's ridiculous as an idea to mass market snake meat. It's just, it's not going to work. People are not going to go.
No, hold on. I'm not trying to get into the snake meat business myself. But there's 2 billion people in the world that eat flies and insects, and we don't do it in the West.
They eat that because they have to. No one goes, oh yeah, I can't wait to eat some insects today. And I mean, most of those cultures, like, you know, when people talk about, you know, insects being a new protein source, like, yes, theoretically, and we could farm the hell out of it, but most people, if you give them a choice of a chicken sandwich or a mosquito, most people would probably choose the chicken sandwich. And
fair. I think it's worth asking the question. No?
Oh, no? Oh man. Oh, boy. Oh, this is why we don't ask you on that often. Our final story is on cow insulin.
God, I cannot compete with the snakes, but if you will, do me a favor. So it's 1922 and we're in a hospital in Toronto and we have a 14-year-old boy who is, and I'm sorry to take down the jovial mood, dying in his hospital bed. His glucose is through the roof and nobody knows what to do. Millions have died before him in the same way. And along comes the team under Frederick Banting and John McLeod, and they inject insulin that they have purified from the pancreas of a cow. And this child lives. And everyone is flabbergasted because diabetes has been a terminal illness up until this point. By 1978, insulin is coming from bacteria and yeast. And now our brand new story is from the University of Illinois in Sao Paulo, and it's going to come from cow's milk. So this has been theorized for a long time, but they've finally produced the first cow that is producing insulin in her milk. It's published in the Biotechnology Journal, and what they did was they transfected her with a gene that makes insulin, but they made sure it's only produced in the mammary gland. It makes human insulin, so it's not cow insulin, so there should be no allergenic problems. And it's only produced in her mammary gland to obviously stop her producing too much insulin, which can also be fatal. And what they were able to do was from 1 liter of milk, they were able to purify 1 gram of insulin, which does not sound like a lot, but that is 30,000 units. Now, these cows can make about 50 litres. If you milk them twice, let's say that's 100 litres. So if you have 100 cows milking 100 litres a day, then we're talking about 300 million units of insulin a day. So obviously people need differing amounts, but a fair average is maybe 10 units of insulin per dose for a person. Wow. Now you need long acting, short acting, that kind of thing. But we could be talking about every day from one small herd of cows, 30 million doses of insulin, which is pretty phenomenal. It means that, you know, a very, very large herd or a few large herds could theoretically produce enough insulin for the whole world if this becomes FDA approved. Now, this wow. isn't a million miles away. Like, this is really, like, it's amazing because you don't need
the
sterility.
It's not snake meat.
It's not snake meat. This is real. This isn't mosquito versus chicken sandwich. This is real. And which was a beautiful comparison, by the way. This is very real. And also, you don't need the sterility of a lab to grow the yeast and the bacteria. You still need quite a clean farm, but they're cows. They're just cows that live on a farm. You milk them and then it heads to the lab. It gets cleaned up. And obviously, it'll need to be modified. There's different types of insulin. There's not just one type of insulin. But this has the potential to bring the cost of insulin down phenomenally. Now, insulin in places like Ireland, where, you know, we have a very good healthcare system, we get for free. You get it on the chronic drug scheme. But in other places like America or places that have lower socioeconomic background, people cannot afford insulin and people die with diabetes. And this could be a game changer. It really is. I just think it's so exciting. Now, they need to scale it up. They need to make more cows. They're hoping to make a transgenic bull who will mate with the transgenic cow and make a transgenic baby. But at the moment, they don't have that. They just have one cow. But they're working on more.
That sounds amazing. I mean, you just summed up those extra steps really, really, really quickly, which do sound like significant challenges, actually.
They do, in fairness. But, you know, let's think big.
No, and you know what? It's always good and rare on this program to end on a positive and really quite evidence-based story that we haven't trashed.
Yeah, I see your shade. Look, listen, snake meat is the future. That's all I'm saying.
Snake oil salesman part two. All right, Phil Smith and Dr. Lara Dungan, thanks so much for your time. Tropical beaches are some of the most idyllic places on our planet. They fuel our daydreams on cold, wet Irish days. And for many of us, they are the primary aim of a holiday, to be lazing around for one on a week or two. But 80% of the sand on that pristine tropical beach you're imagining came out the back end of an animal. That is just one of the many examples of how massive an influence animal poo has had on our ecosystems. Joe Roman is a conservation biologist and marine ecologist at the University of Vermont, and he's written a book called Eat, Poop, Die, How Animals Make Our World. He joins me now. Joe, it's great to have you on the program. I should probably start off by saying that we, judging by the enthusiasm and relish that you approach this subject, are on very opposite poles of the fecophile, fecophobe spectrum. So just go gently with me, if that's okay.
I'll do my best.
So this is interesting. You talk about the forests being the lungs of the planet, but that animals form a circulation system. I love this idea. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, so I think we're all familiar, you know, with the plants around us, that they're absorbing CO2 and then releasing oxygen, and the world depends on that.
Yeah.
Which is essential, but the problem with trees is that they don't move. So where they land, they stay for life. And this is where animals come into play. Think about whales, birds, butterflies. They're all moving humans. We're all moving all the time. We're eating in one place and, forgive me, pooping in another often, and often dying somewhere else. And one of my colleagues described this as the circulatory system of the planet, that animals are like the beating heart. They move nitrogen, they move phosphorus, iron, all the essential nutrients that we need to survive are being moved sometimes thousands of kilometers by animals. Without it, the world would look different.
You know, I'd never really thought about them in that way. And I think it's a fantastic analogy, the idea that they are moving nutrients around the body, much like the circulatory system of an animal. So in the book, you detail these three things, eating, pooping, and dying, and how they have an enormous effect on shaping the world in which we live. Tell me a few stories from the book regarding the contribution that animals make to shaping our world.
Sure. So I work as a whale ecologist, and oceans are complicated. Whales have, by the way, enormous fecal plumes that have an impact, but it's really hard to
tease apart. Sorry, what is a fecal plume?
A fecal plume is basically poop that's kind of widely dispersed. So a whale rises to the surface after feeding, rests, it's digesting, and often just before it dives, it releases, couldn't be the size of a boat, feces that disperses really quickly. It can be bright red and float at the surface. It can be sort of a dull green. I describe it as oversteeped green tea.
Oh, man.
And I've thought about the impact of that throughout my career. How might this be impacting the oceans? And we found that whales can move nutrients much as rivers. You know, we think of rivers and how that changes how they move nutrients downstream. Whales are doing something different. They're diving deep, coming to the surface, and moving those nutrients up to the surface. Why is that important? Because that's where the light is. That's the only place you have photosynthesis. There can be plenty of nutrients in the deep sea, but nothing's growing on them until they get to the surface and these phytoplankton can pick it up. The problem with these studies is we're often inferring what the impact is because there are whales, there are fish, there are phytoplankton, there's zooplankton. You know, it's really complicated. As one of my colleagues said, ecology isn't rocket science. It's a lot harder, right? Because you have thousands of interactions that are going all the time.
Right.
So I start the book on Surtsey Island. Why? Because this island emerged in 1963, no life at all off the coast of Iceland. There were fishermen right there watching as it emerged from the ocean. It took a couple of years.
Presumably a volcanic eruption. Is that what you mean?
Volcanic eruption, right, along the mid-Atlantic ridge in the middle of the ocean, comes up. And of course, it's hot lava. Nothing's alive on it. And Icelandic scientists made the right decision, I think, and said, okay, we're going to make this a living laboratory. Now we have a place on the planet where we can see how life emerges. Right. So nothing's there. A few plants come in. First seeds blow in, but they don't really have enough nutrients to survive. They don't have enough food to sort of germinate.
Yeah.
But there are some large seeded plants like Sea Rocket that land and survive along the edges. So a little bit of life sort of making its way. Everything changes in the late 1970s and early 1980s after a few guillemots, a few seabirds start to nest there. Then dozens and eventually hundreds of seabirds are there. And if you know seabirds, you also know they poop. About 3 ounces or 85 grams of poop are released per bird per day. So about 60 kilos of nitrogen per hectare. That's not that different from a farm system. In fact, one of the researchers joked that they could probably now have cows out there because the pasture is so good. Of course, cows aren't allowed there.
You're saying that this sort of nitrogen bed of seabird crap essentially created enough nutrients to start a pasture, it was soil enough just on volcanic rock to create a habitat for grasses?
That's right. So the volcanic forces release a lot of phosphorus for this. So there's plenty of phosphorus there. Nitrogen is limited. And the nitrogen that these birds are releasing, and they're also bringing seeds over on their legs or in their feathers, is enough to start building some thin soil, but enough in the beginning of a very thin soil, enough over time that there's now 50 times the biomass of grass in the areas where the birds are compared to where they aren't. And this is like a dream for ecologists to have a very simple system that people are watching year to year. The first plants on that island, one of the biologists said, they pretty much knew every individual by name, right? You know, there were so few. And that would have been the same for the birds. But it's not a linear. All of a sudden, once you have a couple of hundred birds, then everything changes. And that allows us to see just how animals can influence the system. And this is true. It's that it emerged in 1963. So I went there in 2021. And you get off land on that island, and it looks like you're landing on the moon at first until you get to the area where the birds are. It's noisy, it's a little bit smelly, and it's full of life. And not only are they bringing in the grasses, then insects are coming in as well, and they can survive in those grasslands. So you're starting to build an ecosystem from scratch. And I didn't know this for the book, but when I gave the book to one of the researchers, Borgþór Magnússon, he said that the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission in the 1960s and early 70s actually funded the work on that island because they wanted to know what would happen after a massive blast. So, wow. In a way, this is kind of like a post-apocalyptic landscape. And the seabirds really drive, or, you know, sort of are the showrunners.
So the time span to finding, you know, a lush vegetation from bold volcanic rock is only 50 years, 40 years?
Even less. That started in the 1980s. So it was really only about 20 or 30 years, 20 years really when it started to change. And now, 60 years later, there are 80 plant species that have been found on the island, a couple of dozen birds, lots of new insects are found in there. So, you know, it takes this, in this case, the catalyst was the nitrogen brought over by the seabirds. But now somebody else has moved in too, and the seals, gray seals, are starting to pop there.
Wow.
And they're, of course, bringing in lots of nutrients too. And the same with the seabirds and seals, they're eating largely fish or krill, and then they come to the land to rest and to have their offspring, and releasing either poop or, in the case of seabirds, eggs. Sometimes they're dying. With seals, it could be poop, urine, or placentas.
It sounds like Minecraft, but in real life, you know, just mine a bit, lay down a little bit of this, wait some time, and then the animals arrive. That's really cool. So that's the poop part. And you do spend quite a lot of time talking about various animals that have an enormous effect on ecosystems and so on, just from that. But when animals die, they also create ecosystems and are also really important for certain species. Can you take me through some of those?
Sure. I mentioned I'm a whale ecologist, and this is another one we've only known relatively recently. In the 1980s, people knew nothing about what happened after a whale died and sank to the deep sea. But with remote vehicles and with deep diving vehicles, people have been observing whale carcasses at thousands of meters beneath the surface. And we're shocked to find that there were hundreds of species dependent on these carcasses. They're called whale falls, and they're almost like deep sea islands. First, you would have the usual suspects would show up, like sharks and hagfish. Basically, they're eating the blubber and they're eating the soft tissue. Mm. But then it gets interesting. Once that soft tissue is gone, there are worms like the Osedax worm, or bone-eating worm, that lands on the bones of the whales, and they have enormous bones, of course. And they actually don't have a mouth, they don't have an anus, and they don't have a gut. What they do have, these animals, is a root system that allows them to access the nutrients in the whale bones. They provide that to bacteria that are inside of them. The bacteria grow and give them the sugars and the proteins and the amino acids that they need. There have been 100 species, worms, clams, and others, found on whale falls alone. So these species, as far as we know, are completely dependent on dead whales. And they've been around for tens of millions of years doing this, it looks like, these communities. Unfortunately, as we know, there was very heavy hunting around from like 1900 or even earlier to the 1960s of whales. We didn't really cause any direct extinction of whales, but we might have caused the extinction of some of these deep sea organisms before we even knew they existed, because we took their habitat away without even knowing it existed, right? So that system is fascinating. And, you know, it's like seeing, envisioning a different world all on really the backs of whales.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to witness the live expedition of, I think it was the Nautilus is the name of the expedition craft that plonked itself down on the seabed beside a whale carcass. And it was actually fascinating. Just sit there and see these creatures come and go and feed off the whale carcass. It was very relaxing. So these carcasses on the sea, though, they're not, I mean, I suppose it's unfair to say that it depends on your viewpoint, but they're not significant when it comes to large ecosystems. Would that be fair to say there aren't that many whale carcasses on the ground that are creating habitats for all of these species? Or are we underestimating the impact that cadavers have on a healthy and functioning ecosystem across our planet?
Oh, I think we do underestimate it. And that's really just an emerging, like, you know, carcass ecology is just starting to emerge, and whales are hard to study. You know, a lot of the information we're now getting from dead whales is ones that we dragged out there and sank. We didn't kill them, but they might have washed up on shore. Because, of course, as you know, if you've been out at sea, it's not cheap and it's not easy to access these areas. Another example, which is just amazing, and I was fortunate enough to see it, is in the Pacific Northwest, and this would be true in Ireland as well, salmon migrations. So we often think of gravity as how nutrients move, but salmon, of course, are feeding offshore, and then they're coming upstream to breed. And in the Pacific Northwest, they're semelparous, which means they just breed once. So they have one time that they go upriver, and they spawn, and then they die. And those carcasses, you can see them littered around the forest floor. How do they get so far from the river? Often dragged out by bears. Brown bears in particular are feeding on them and then spreading those nutrients. So you can find evidence of the nutrients from the ocean hundreds of meters away from the river that were either dragged out or pooped out or in many cases peed or urinated by the bears. And this can get right into those tree systems and possibly change forest ecosystems. I say possibly because this is one where there's some active debate about just how important the salmon are, but there's no question that they play an essential role to the other animals around there. The role in the forest is still a bit of a hot debate.
Yeah, but I suppose, you know, if you think of that sort of circulatory system across the entire planet, there must have been moments in time where enough of something like that happened that a species gained a foothold and through natural evolution took advantage and became, you know, the trees that we see in a forest or the crabs that we see on the rocks of a shore.
Absolutely. And, you know, what we're looking out at a world that's largely depauperate of wild animals. I'm looking out my window. I'm actually in rural Vermont. I maybe see a bird or two. Mostly I'm seeing some plants. But if we went back before human impact, there were 25 times as many mammals on the planet as they are now by biomass. Right now, we live in a world that's dominated by people, by people, by cows, by sheep, by pigs. Only 4% of the mammals on the planet are wild, and that includes whales and deer and all those other wild species we think of. So I would argue that's part of the reason we don't think animals are that important, because we've taken them out of the system. Mm. And when we return them, it's kind of a natural experiment, and we start to see the world change when you restore these animals. One of the terms we use is rewilding or trophic rewilding.
Yeah, actually, we should do a piece on rewilding. It's been a while since we've talked about that, but I wanted to finish up this article talking about beaches and the tropical beaches that I mentioned at the front, because I had no idea that this was the case. But beaches are essentially created through the process of defecation. Can you tell me exactly how beaches come about?
Sure. This is amazing to me, too. So you started out talking about tropical beaches, right? And you're sitting there and the waters are clear and you're on a beach and it probably has some different colored sand and it seems very comfortable, and it is. It's hard to imagine, though, that 80% of the sand that you're sitting on has been passed through an animal or is from a dead animal. And the main driver here is the parrotfish. Hmm. And it gets its name because its teeth form sort of a beak-like front. And they can almost, like we could eat through a Tootsie Pop or candy or hard candy, they can bite through corals. It sounds almost like they're biting through concrete. They're feeding multiple times a minute. So bite, 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 bite. Yeah. And then they're pooping more than 22 times an hour. And for someone who studies poop, that's really nice because it's easy to find and easy to see. And I could swim through those plumes, and it's mostly sand. It also comes out of their gills. They sometimes look like locomotives while they're swimming. So think about that volcanic island like Surtsey I described. If it was a tropical island, it's going to erode over time and disappear off the coast of Iceland. But in the tropics where you have these fish and other animals that are feeding and excreting sand, they're excreting enough that three large parrotfish deliver as much sand as a concrete mixer over the course of a year. So we're talking a lot just by three animals.
Wow.
That's enough to keep the island growing even as the original volcanic part is eroding away. And people are excited about the idea that if we can restore and maintain these parrotfish, we can actually, they can actually keep up with climate change. So it might allow some of these shallow beach, these low-lying beaches to persist. And, you know, this these species, like many, are at risk. And in areas where they're found, they behave differently. They make big differences in those tropical ecosystems. Right. So spank them when you're there. And I should add, just to be clear, this is they're feeding on coral reefs. So in cold areas like where I am, New England or Ireland, if you don't have shallow reef systems, it's going to be more through erosion that those beaches are formed. So
I'm cool with that. I'm perfectly cool that the beaches of Ireland are not made that way, Joe. But a really fascinating story and a really entertaining book that might make you think a little bit more about how animals shape our world. It's called Eat, Poop, Die, How Animals Make Our World. Joe Roman, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, that wasn't all that bad, was it? There is quite a lot of talk about waste in that book, and I was kind of concerned. I don't know why I am, like, I've had two children. I don't know why I am so skittish around scat, but it's just not, I don't know. I just don't like talking about it. That's it from us on this week's program. I hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to comment on any of our stories, we love to hear your thoughts, your emails, and so on. You can email them to us, science@newstalk.com. We'll get to your comments in next week's podcast. But for now, thanks to Aidan McKelvey and the rest of the team. And we will be back on Tuesday with more in your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.